Chapter 47. A Teaching Chamber. Fael sat impatiently atop daylight, trying to keep herself from twitching as the gateway split the air. A browning meadow lay on the other side. Gaul and the maidens immediately slipped through to scout.
"Are you certain you don't want to come?"
Perrin asked Galad, who stood nearby, watching the procession with arms clasped behind his back.
"No," Galad said. "My meal with Elaine was sufficient for us to catch up." "Sit yourself," Perrin said.
He turned to Fael and gestured to the gateway. She kicked daylight into motion. It was time, at long last, to face the Queen of Andor, and she had to work to contain her nervousness. Perrin passed through the gateway with her. On the other side, Camelin was close, the grand city topped by peaked towers and banners of red and white, palace rising in the center. Low Camelin, which sprawled outside the city walls, was a growing city of its own. Perrin's procession followed them out of the gateway. It had been carefully planned to look impressive, but not hostile. Aleandra with 100 guardsmen, 102 Rivers archers with unstrung longbows carried like staves, 100 representatives of the Wolf Guard, including a large contingent of minor Kyrian nobility, the colored slashes on their uniforms created from cloth purchased in Whitebridge, and, of course, Gaul and the maidens. Grady came last. The man wore a neatly pressed black coat, his dedicated pin polished and gleaming on the high collar. He immediately looked westward, toward the Black Tower. He'd tried to make a gateway there earlier in the day when Perrin had given him permission. It hadn't worked. Perrin was disturbed by that. He intended to investigate soon, tonight or tomorrow night at the latest. Gaul and the maidens formed up around Perrin and Fael, and the procession moved down onto the road, Arganda and a squad of Perrin's wolf guards riding ahead to announce them. The rest of them moved along the road at a regal pace. Camelin's sprawling growth was even worse than that of Whitebridge. Several armies camped near Low Camelin, probably supported by the various lords who had supported Elaine's ascent to the throne. There was a distinct irregularity here. The clouds broke around Camelin. The cloud cover had been so universal elsewhere that Fael started upon seeing this. The clouds formed an open circle above the city, eerily even. Arganda and the wolf guards returned.
"They will receive us, my lord, my lady," he announced.
Fael and Perrin rode in silence as the group made its way down the road. They had discussed the coming meeting dozens of times over. There wasn't anything more to say. Perrin had wisely given her the lead in the diplomatic negotiations. The world could not afford war between Andor and the Two Rivers. Not now. As they passed through the city gates, Perrin and the Aiel grew more alert. She suffered their overprotectiveness in silence. How long would her capture by the Shido loom over her life? At times it seemed Perrin was loath to let her use the privy without 4 dozen guards. Inside the walls, the streets teemed with people, the buildings and markets packed. Refuse was beginning to pile up, and a frightening number of urchins moved through the crowds. Criers yelled about the dangerous times, some perhaps in the employ of the merchants, encouraging people to hoard. Perrin's people had bought food here, but it was expensive. Soon Elaine would need to subsidize it, if she hadn't already. How good were the royal stores? They passed through the new city, then entered the inner city, climbing the hill to the palace itself. The Queen's guard stood at attention in their red and white tabards and burnished plate and mail outside the palace gates in the pristine white palace walls. Once past the gates, they dismounted. A force of 100 continued on with Perrin and Fael into the palace. All of the Aiel and a smaller honor guard from each contingent. The palace hallways were wide, but that many people still made Fael feel crowded, The path she and Perrin were led along was a different way to the throne room than she'd taken before. Why not use the direct way? It seemed that little had changed about the palace since Rand's time ruling it. There were no Aiel now, save for the ones Perrin had brought. The same narrow red rug ran down the middle of the hallway, the same urns at the corners, the same mirrors on the walls to give an illusion of greater size. A structure like this could stand unaltered over the centuries, paying little attention to whose feet trod the rugs and whose backside warmed the throne. In 1 year's time, this palace had known Morghais, one of the Forsaken, the Dragon Reborn, and finally Elaine. In fact, Fael half expected, as they rounded the corner to the throne room, to find Rand lounging on his dragon throne, that strange half-spear held in the crook of his arm, a glimmer of madness in his eyes. However, the dragon throne had been removed, and the lion throne again held its queen. Rand had set that throne aside and protected it, like a flower he intended to present to a future love. The queen was a younger version of her mother. True, Elaine's face had angles that were more delicate than Morghais's, but she had that same red-gold hair and that same stunning beauty. She was tall and was showing her pregnancy at the belly and through the chest. The throne room was suitably ornate, with gilded wood trim and narrow pillars in the corners, probably ornamental. Elaine kept the room better lit than Rand had, stand lamps burning brightly. Morghais herself stood at the base of the throne on the right side, and 8 members of the Queen's Guard stood on the left. Some lesser nobles lined the sides of the room, watching with keen attention. Elaine leaned forward on her throne as Perrin, Fael, and the others entered. Fael curtsied, of course, and Perrin bowed. Not a low bow, but a bow nonetheless. By arrangement, Aleandra curtsied deeper than Fael had. That would immediately set Elaine thinking. The official purpose of this visit was a commendation by the crown, a thanks to Perrin and Fael for bringing back Morghais. That was just an affectation, of course. Their real reason for meeting was to discuss the future of the Two Rivers. But that was the sort of delicate goal that neither could speak of outright, at least not at first. Merely stating the objective would reveal too much to the other side. "Let it be known," Elaine said with a musical voice, "that the throne welcomes you, Lady Zareen ni Bashir Tebara, Queen Aleandra Maritha Kigarin, Perrin Ebara," no use of title for him. "Let it be proclaimed in person our gratitude to you for returning our mother. Your diligence in this matter earns you the crown's deepest appreciation."
"Thank you, Your Majesty," Perrin said with his usual gruffness.
Fael had spoken to him at length about not trying to dispense with the formality or ceremony. "We will declare a day of celebration for my mother's safe return," Elaine continued, "and for her restoration to proper status." Well, that pause meant Elaine was displeased to know that her mother had been treated as a servant. She had to realize that Perrin and Fael hadn't known what they were doing, but a queen could still claim indignation for such an event. It was an edge that, perhaps, she planned to use. Perhaps Fael was reading too much into the comments, but she couldn't help it. In many ways, being a lady was much like being a merchant, and she had been trained well for both roles. "Finally," Elaine said, "we come to the purpose of our meeting. Lady Bashir, Master Ebara, is there a boon you would ask in return for the gift you have given to Andor?" Perrin rested his hand on his hammer, then looked to Fael questioningly. Obviously, Elaine expected them to ask for him to be named formally a lord, or perhaps to ask forbearance for impersonating one, along with a formal pardon. Either direction could be a result of this conversation. Fael was tempted to demand the first, It would be a simple answer. But perhaps too simple. There were things Fail had to know before they could proceed.
Your Majesty, Fail said carefully, might we discuss this boon in a more intimate setting?
Elaine gave that some thought, at least 30 seconds worth, which seemed an infinity.
Very well. My sitting room is prepared.
Fail nodded, and a servant opened a small door on the left-hand wall of the throne room. Perrin walked toward it, then held up a hand to Gaul, Sulin, and Arganda.
Wait here.
He hesitated, glancing at Grady.
You too.
None of them seemed to like that, but they obeyed. They'd been warned this might happen. Fail contained her nervousness. She didn't like leaving the Ashaman, their best means of escape, particularly since Elaine undoubtedly had spies and guards hidden inside the sitting room, ready to spring out should matters turn dangerous. Fail would have liked a similar protection, but bringing a male channeler in to speak with the queen, well, this was how it would have to be. They were in Elaine's domain. Fail took a deep breath, joining Perrin, Aleandra, and Morghais in the small side room. Chairs had been arranged. Elaine had foreseen this possibility. They waited for Elaine to enter before sitting. Fail couldn't see any place for guards to be hiding. Elaine entered and waved a hand. The great serpent ring on her finger glittered in the lamplight. Fail had nearly forgotten that she was Aes Sedai. Perhaps there wouldn't be any guardsmen lurking around to help. A woman who could channel was as dangerous as a dozen soldiers. Which of the rumors regarding the father of Elaine's child were to be believed? Surely not the ones about that fool of a man in her guard. That was most likely obfuscation. Could it possibly be Rand himself? Morghais entered after Elaine. She wore a subdued gown of deep red. She sat down beside her daughter, watching carefully, remaining silent.
So, Elaine said, explain to me why I shouldn't just execute you both as traitors.
Fail blinked in surprise. Perrin, however, snorted.
I don't think Rand would think very highly of that move.
I'm not beholden to him, Elaine said. You expect me to believe that he was behind you seducing my citizens and naming yourself a king?
You have a few of your facts backward, Your Majesty, Fail said testily. Perrin never named himself king.
Oh, and did he raise the flag of Manetheren, as my informants tell me he did?
Elaine asked.
I did that, Perrin said, but I put it away of my own choice.
Well, that's something, Elaine replied. You may not have called yourself a king, but holding up that banner was essentially the same thing. Oh, sit down, all of you.
She waved a hand. A tray lifted off the far table and floated over to her. It bore goblets and a pitcher of wine, as well as a teapot and cups.
Fetching it with the one power, Fail thought. It's a reminder of her strength. A rather unsubtle one. Still, Elaine said, I will do the best for my realm, regardless of the cost.
I doubt that upsetting the two rivers, Aleandra said hesitantly, would be best for your realm. Executing their leader would undoubtedly throw the region into rebellion.
So far as I'm concerned, Elaine said, pouring several cups of tea, they're already in rebellion.
We came to you peacefully, Fail said. Hardly the action of rebels. Elaine took a sip of the tea first, as was the custom, to prove it wasn't poisoned.
My envoys to the Two Rivers have been refused, and your people there gave me a message, and I quote, the lands of Lord Perrin Golden Eyes refuse your Andoran taxes. Taishar Manetheren.
Aleandra paled.
Perrin groaned softly, a sound that came out faintly like a growl. Fail took her cup and sipped her tea. Mint, with cloudberries.
It was good. The Two Rivers folk had pluck, that was certain.
"These are passionate times, Your Majesty," Fail said.
"Surely you can see that the people might be concerned. The Two Rivers has not often been a priority for your throne."
"That's putting it mildly," Perrin added with a snort. "Most of us grew up not knowing we were part of Andor. You ignored us."
"That was because the area wasn't rising in rebellion." Elaine sipped her tea.
"Rebellion isn't the only reason men might need the attention of the queen who claims them," Perrin said. "I don't know if you've heard, but last year we faced Trollocs on our own, and without a whisker of help from the crown. You'd have helped if you'd known, but the fact that there were no troops nearby, none capable of knowing our danger, says something."
Elaine hesitated. "The Two Rivers has rediscovered its history," Fael said carefully. "It couldn't rest forever, not with Tarmon Gaidon looming. Not after sheltering the dragon reborn during his childhood. Part of me wonders if Manetheran had to fall, if the Two Rivers had to rise, to provide a place for Randall Thor to be raised, among farmers with the blood and obstinacy of kings. Which makes it all the more important that I quiet things now," Elaine said. "I offered you a boon so that you could ask for forgiveness. I'd pardon you, and I'll be certain to send troops so that your people are protected. Accept this, and we can all go back to life the way it should be."
"That isn't going to happen," Perrin said softly. "The Two Rivers will have lords now. I fought it for a time. You may too, but it won't change anything."
"Perhaps," Elaine said. "But recognizing you would be to agree that a man can just claim a title within my nation, then keep it by stubbornly gathering an army. It makes for a terrible precedent, Perrin. I don't think you realize the predicament you've put me in."
"We'll muddle through," Perrin said in that stubborn tone he used when he wasn't going to budge. "I'm not stepping down."
"You're doing a poor job of persuading me you will accept my authority," Elaine snapped. Not good, Fael thought, opening her mouth to jump in. A clash here would not serve them well. Before she could speak, however, another voice cut in. "Daughter," Morghese said softly, drinking her tea, "if you plan to dance with Taviran, be sure that you know the proper steps. I've traveled with this man. I've seen the world bend around him. I've seen bitter enemies become his allies. To fight the pattern itself is to try to move a mountain with a spoon." Elaine hesitated, looking at her mother. "Please forgive me if I overstep myself," Morghese continued. "But Elaine, I promised these two that I would speak for them. I told you I would. Andor is strong, but I fear it could break itself against this man. He does not want your throne, I promise it, and the Two Rivers does need supervision. Would it be such a terrible thing to let them have the man they themselves have chosen?" The small room fell silent. Elaine eyed Perrin, sizing him up. Fael held her breath. "All right," Elaine said. "I assume you've come with demands. Let's hear them so we can discover if there's anything that can be done."
"No demands," Fael said.
"An offer." Elaine raised an eyebrow. "Your mother is right," Fael said. "Perrin does not want your throne. What you two want may be irrelevant once your people get an idea in their minds." Fael shook her head. "They love him, Your Majesty. They respect him. They'll do what he says. We can and will put down ideas of Manetheran rising again."
"And why would you do that?" Elaine asked.
"I know how fast the Two Rivers is growing with those refugees coming in over the mountains. Nations could rise and fall with the coming of the last battle. You have no reason to give up the chance to form your own kingdom."
"Actually," Fael said, "we have good reason. Andor is a strong nation, and prosperous.
The towns in the two rivers may be growing rapidly, but the people have barely begun to want a lord. They're still farmers at heart. They don't want glory. They want their crops to survive. Fael paused. Perhaps you're right. Perhaps there will be another breaking. But that's only more reason to have allies. Nobody wants civil war in Andor. Least of all the Two Rivers folk.
What do you propose, then? Elaine said.
Nothing, really, that doesn't exist already, Fael said. Give Perrin an official title and make him High Lord over the Two Rivers.
And what do you mean by High Lord? Elaine asked.
He'd rank higher than other noble houses in Andor, but beneath the Queen.
I doubt the others would like that, Elaine said. What of taxes?
The Two Rivers is exempt, Fael said. As Elaine's expression soured, she continued quickly. Your Majesty, the throne ignored the Two Rivers for generations, not protecting them from bandits or sending workers to improve their roads, not giving them anything in the way of magistrates or justices.
They didn't need it, Elaine said. They governed themselves fine.
She left unsaid that the Two Rivers folk would probably have tossed out tax collectors, magistrates, or justices sent by the Queen, but she seemed to know it.
Well, Fael said, nothing needs change, then. The Two Rivers governs itself.
You could have tariff-free trade with them, Alejandra said.
Something I already have, Elaine said.
So nothing changes, Fael said again. Except that you gain a powerful province to the west. Perrin, as your ally and subject lord, will agree to marshal troops in your defense. He will also call up his sworn monarchs to your allegiance.
Elaine glanced at Alejandra. She'd probably heard of Alejandra's swearing from Morghais, but also would want to hear it for herself.
I swore fealty to Lord Perrin, Alejandra said. Gildan had long lacked for strong allies. I meant to change that.
Your Majesty, Fael said, leaning forward, tea cupped in her hands before her.
Perrin spent several weeks with some Seanchan officers. They have created a great pact of nations allied beneath one banner. Randall Thor, though you may trust him as a friend, has done the same. Tyr, Ilion, and maybe now Arad Domann are beneath his rule. Nations join rather than split these days. Andor looks smaller by the hour.
That's why I did what I did, Alejandra said.
Well, in Fael's view, Alejandra had been caught up by Perrin as a Ta'veren. There hadn't been much planning. But Alejandra might see it otherwise.
Your Majesty, Fael continued, there is much to gain here.
Through my marriage to Perrin, you gain a tie to Saldaea. Through Alejandra's oaths, you gain Gildan. Berylaine also follows Perrin, and has often mentioned her desire to find strong allies for Mayenne. If we were to speak with her, I suspect she might be willing to make an alliance with us. We could create our own pact. 5 nations, if you count the Two Rivers as one. 6, if you do take the Sun Throne, as rumor claims you will.
We are not the most powerful nations, but the many are stronger than the one, and you would be at our head.
Elaine's face had lost almost all of its hostility.
Saldaea, what are you in its line of succession?
I'm second, Fael admitted, which Elaine probably already knew. Perrin shifted in his chair. She knew he was still uncomfortable with that fact. Well, he would simply have to get used to it.
Second is too close, Elaine replied.
What if you end up with the throne of Saldaea? I could lose the Two Rivers to another country that way.
This is easy to fix, Alejandra said.
If Fael were to ascend, one of her and Perrin's children could continue as Lord of the Two Rivers. Another could take the throne of Saldaea. Put it in writing and you will be protected.
I could accept such an arrangement, Elaine said.
I don't have problems with it, Fael replied, looking at Perrin.
I suppose.
I should like one of them myself, Elaine said thoughtfully. One of your children, I mean, to marry into the Andoran royal line.
If the Two Rivers is to be ruled by a lord with as much power as this treaty would give him, then I would love to have blood connections to the throne.
I won't promise that, Perrin said. My children will make their own choices.
It is sometimes the way of nobility, Elaine said. It would be unusual, but not unheard of, for children like ours to be engaged from birth.
We won't do it that way in the Two Rivers, Perrin said stubbornly. Ever.
Fael shrugged. We could offer encouragement, Your Majesty. Elaine hesitated, then nodded. That will be fine. But the other houses won't like this High Lord business. There'd need to be a way around it.
Give the Two Rivers to the Dragon Reborn,
Morghese said. Elaine's eyes lit up. Yes, that would work. If I gave the area to him to be his seat in Andor...
Fael opened her mouth, but Elaine cut her off with a wave of the hand.
This isn't negotiable. I'll need some way to convince the other lords and ladies that I'm right to give the Two Rivers so much autonomy. If the lands are granted to the Dragon Reborn, giving him a title in Andor and making the Two Rivers his seat, then it will make sense for your home to be treated differently. The noble houses of Andor will accept this, since the Two Rivers is where Rand came from, and Andor does owe him a debt. We'll have him appoint Perrin's line as his stewards. Instead of capitulating to rebels within my borders, I'll be seen allowing the Dragon Reborn, the man I love, to elevate his good friend. It might also give us some ground against the Ilion Tyr Pact you mentioned, who are bound to claim that their ties to Rand give them the right of conquest. She grew thoughtful, tapping the side of her cup.
That seems reasonable, Perrin said, nodding. Steward of the Two Rivers. I like the sound of that.
Yes, well, Fael said. I guess it's settled, then. The taxes, Elaine said, as if she hadn't heard. You put them into a trust to be administered by Perrin and his line, with the understanding that if the dragon ever returns, he can call upon them. Yes. That gives us a legal excuse for your exemption. Of course, Perrin will have authority to dip into those funds to improve the Two Rivers. Roads, food stores, defenses. Elaine looked at Fael, then smiled, taking a long drink of tea. I'm beginning to think it was a good idea not to execute you.
That's certainly a relief, Alejandra said, smiling.
As the least powerful one in the Union, she stood to gain a lot from the alliances.
Your Majesty, Fael said.
Call me Elaine, she said, pouring a goblet of wine for Fael.
Very well, Elaine, Fael said, smiling and putting aside her tea, then accepting the wine. I need to ask, do you know what is happening with the Dragon Reborn?
Ox-brained lummox, Elaine said, shaking her head. The bloody man's got Egwene all riled up.
Egwene? Perrin asked.
She's Amarlin, finally, Elaine said, as if the fact had been inevitable. Perrin nodded, though Fael found herself amazed. How had that happened, and why wasn't Perrin surprised by it?
What's he gone and done? Perrin asked.
He says he's going to break the remaining seals of the Dark One's prison, Elaine said, frowning. We'll need to stop him, of course. Foolish plan. You could help with that. Egwene's gathering a force to persuade him.
I think I could be of help, Perrin said.
Do you know where he is currently? Fael asked. Perrin had a good idea from his visions, but she wanted to know what Elaine knew. I don't know, Elaine said, but I do know where he will be.
Fortuona Atham Devi Pendrag, ruler of the glorious Shonshan Empire, marched into her teaching chamber. She wore a magnificent gown of golden cloth, cut after the highest imperial fashion. The skirt split at the front just above the knees, and was so long that it took 5 Dakovale to carry the sides and train. She wore an ornate headdress of gold and crimson silk, with beautiful silken wings shaped like those of an owl taking flight, and her arms glittered with 13 bracelets,
each of a different gemstone combination. She wore crystal at her throat in a long strand. She had heard an owl above her window the last night, and it had not flown away when she looked out, an omen indicating great care should be taken, that the next days would be ones of important decisions. The proper response was to wear jewelry with powerful symbolism. When she entered the chamber, those inside prostrated themselves. Only the Death Watch guard, men in armor of blood red and deep green, was exempt. They bowed but kept their eyes up, watching for danger. The large chamber was windowless. Lines of stacked pottery stood at one end, a place for Damani to practice weaves of destruction. The floor was covered in woven mats where stubborn Damani were sent to the ground, writhing in pain. It would not do for them to be harmed physically. Damani were among the most important tools the Empire had, more valuable than horses or rakan. You did not destroy a beast because it was slow to learn. You punished it until it learned. Fortuona crossed the chamber to where a proper imperial throne had been set up. She commonly came here to watch the Damani being worked or broken. It soothed her. The throne was atop a small dais. She climbed the steps, train rustling as her dakovail carried it. She turned to face the room, allowing the servants to arrange her dress. They took her by the arms and lifted her back into the throne, draping her long golden skirts down the front of the dais like a tapestry. Those skirts were sewn with the writings of imperial power. The Empress is Shan Shan. The Empress will live forever. The Empress must be obeyed. She sat as a living banner to the might of the Empire. Seleucia took her position on the lower steps of the dais. This done, the courtiers raised themselves. The Damani, of course, remained kneeling. There were 10 of them, with heads bowed, their suldam holding their leashes, and in a few cases patting them affectionately on the heads. King Beslan entered. He'd shaved most of his head, leaving only a dark strip on the top, and 7 of his fingernails had been lacquered. One more fingernail than anyone on this side of the ocean, excepting Fortuona herself. He still wore Altaran clothing, a uniform of green and white, rather than Shan Shan robes. She had not pressed him on this. So far as she knew, since his raising, Beslan hadn't made any plans to have her assassinated. Remarkable. Any Shan Shan would have immediately begun scheming. Some would have tried an assassination. Others would have decided to make only plans but remain supportive. But all would have considered killing her. Many on this side of the ocean thought differently. She'd never have believed it, if not for her time with Matrim. That was obviously one reason why Fortuona had been required to go with him. She just wished she'd interpreted the omens earlier. Beslan was joined by Captain General Lunal Galgan and a few members of the Low Blood. Galgan was a wide-shouldered fellow with a crest of white hair atop his head. The other members of the Blood deferred to him. They knew he had her favor. If things went well here and with the reclamation of Shan Shan, there was a good chance she'd raise him to the Imperial family. The ranks of the family would need to be refilled, after all, once Fortuona returned and restored order. Undoubtedly, many had been assassinated or executed. Galgan was a valuable ally. He'd not only worked openly against Suroth, but had suggested the assault on the White Tower, which had gone well, extremely well. Melitene, Fortuona's Dur Suldam, stepped forward and bowed again. The stout, graying woman led a Damani with dark brown hair and bloodshot eyes. Apparently this one wept often. Melitene had the presence to look embarrassed at the weeping, and bowed extra low. Fortuona chose not to notice that the Damani was acting so displeasingly. This one was a fine catch, despite her petulance. Fortuona made a series of gestures to Seleucia, instructing her in what to say. The woman watched with keen eyes, half of her head covered in cloth while she waited for the hair to grow there, the other half shaved. Fortuona would eventually have to choose another voice, as Seleucia was now her truth-speaker. "Show us what this woman can do," Seleucia said, voicing the words Fortuona had signed to her. Melitene patted the Damani on the head. "Suffa will show the Empress, may she live forever, the power of slicing the air." "Please," Suffa said, looking pleadingly toward Fortuona. "Please, listen to me. I am the Ammerlin's seat." Melitene hissed, and Suffa's eyes opened wide, obviously feeling a blast of pain through the Adam. The Damani continued anyway. "I can offer great bounty, powerful Empress. If I am returned, I will give you 10 women to take my place. 20. The most powerful the White Tower has. I..." She broke off, moaning, and collapsed to the ground. Melitene was sweating. She looked to Seleucia, speaking quickly, nervously. "Please explain to the Empress of us all, may she live forever, that my eyes are lowered for not having trained this one properly. Suffa is amazingly stubborn, despite how quick she is to weep and offer others in her place." Fortuona sat for a moment, letting Melitene sweat. Eventually she signed for Seleucia to speak. "The Empress is not displeased with you," Seleucia voiced. "These Marath Damani who call themselves Aes Sedai have all proven stubborn." "Please express my gratitude to the greatest one," Melitene said, relaxing. "If it pleases she whose eyes look upward, I can make Suffa perform, but there may be further outbursts." "You may continue," Seleucia voiced. Melitene knelt beside Suffa, speaking sharply at first, then consolingly. She was very skilled at working with former Marath Damani. Of course, Fortuona considered herself good with Damani as well. She enjoyed breaking Marath Damani as much as her brother Halvate had enjoyed training Wild Grum. She'd always found it a pity that he had been assassinated. He was the only one of her brothers who she'd ever been fond of. Suffa finally got back onto her knees. Fortuona leaned forward, curious. Suffa bowed her head, and a line of light, brilliant and pure, cut the air in front of her. That line turned sideways along a central axis, opening a hole directly in front of Fortuona's throne. Trees rustled beyond, and Fortuona's breath caught as she saw a hawk with a white head streak away from the portal, an omen of great power. The normally unflappable Seleucia gasped, though whether it was at the portal or the omen, Fortuona did not know. Fortuona covered her own surprise. So it was true. Traveling wasn't a myth or a rumor. It was real. This changed everything about the war. Veselin walked forward, bowing to her, looking hesitant. She waved for him and Galgun to come to where they could see the forest glade through the opening. Veselin stared, mouth hanging open. Galgun clasped his hands behind his back. He was a curious one. He'd met with assassins in the city and had inquired about the cost for having Fortuona killed. Then he'd had each of the men who quoted him a price executed. A very subtle maneuver. It was meant to show that she should consider him a threat, as he was not afraid of meeting with assassins. However, it was also a visible sign of loyalty. "I follow you for now," the move said, "but I am watching, and I am ambitious." In many ways, his careful maneuvering was more comforting to her than Beslan's apparently unwavering loyalty. The first, she could anticipate. The second? Well, she wasn't certain what to make of it yet. Would Matrim be equally loyal? What would it be like to have a prince of the ravens whom she did not have to plot against? It seemed almost a fantasy, the type of tale told to common children to make them dream of an impossible marriage.
"This is incredible," Veselin said. "Greatest one with this ability."
His station made him one of the only people able to speak directly to her. "The Empress wishes to know," Seleucia voiced, reading Fortuona's fingers, "if any of the captured Marath Damani spoke of the weapon." "Tell the highest Empress, may she live forever, that they did not," Melitene said, sounding worried.
and if I may be so bold, I believe that they are not lying. It seems that the explosion outside the city was an isolated accident, the result of some unknown Turang Rial used imprudently. Perhaps there is no weapon. It was possible, for Tuona had already begun to doubt the validity of those rumors. The explosion had happened before Fortuona had arrived in Ebu Dar, and the details were confusing. Perhaps this had all been a ploy by Suroth or her enemies.
"Captain General," Seleucia voiced, "the Greatest One wishes to know what you would do with a power such as this traveling ability."
"That depends," Galgun said, rubbing his chin. "What is its range? How large can she make it? Can all Damani do this? Are there limitations on where a hole can be opened? If it pleases the Greatest One, I will speak with the Damani and get these answers."
"It does please the Empress," Seleucia voiced.
"This is troubling," Beslan said. "They could attack behind our battle lines. They could open a portal like this into the Empress's own chambers, may she live forever. With this, everything we know about war will change."
The members of the Death Watch Guard shuffled, a sign of great discomfort. Only Furik Kharid did not move. If anything, his expression grew harder, for Tuona knew that he would soon be suggesting a new, rotating location of her sleeping quarters. Fortuna thought for a moment, staring at that rent in the air, that rent in reality itself. Then, contrary to tradition, she stood up on her dais. Fortunately, Beslan was there, one she could address directly, and let the others hear her commands.
"Reports say," Fortuna announced, "that there are still hundreds of Marath Domani in the place called the White Tower. They are the key to recapturing Shanchan, the key to holding this land, and the key to preparing for the last battle. The Dragon Reborn will serve the Crystal Throne. We have been provided with a way to strike. Let it be said to the Captain General that he should gather his finest soldiers. I want each and every Damani we control to be brought back to the city. We will train them in this method of traveling, and then we will go in force to the White Tower, before we struck them with a pinprick. Now we will let them know the full weight of our sword. All of the Marath Damani must be leashed." She sat back down, letting the room fall still. It was rare that the Empress made such announcements personally, but this was a time for boldness.
"You should not allow word of this to spread," Seleucia said to her, voice firm. She was now speaking in her role as truth speaker. Yes, another would have to be chosen to be Fortuna's voice.
"You would be a fool to let the enemy know for certain we have this traveling."
Fortuna took a deep breath. Yes, that was true. She would make certain each in this room was held to secrecy. But once the White Tower was captured, they would talk of her proclamation, and would read the omens of her victory upon the skies and world around them.
"We will need to strike soon," Seleucia signed.
"Yes," Fortuna signed back. "Our previous attack will have them gathering arms."
"Our next move will have to be decisive, then," Seleucia signed. "But think, delivering thousands of soldiers into the White Tower through a hidden basement room, striking with the force of 1,000 hammers against 1,000 anvils."
Fortuna nodded. The White Tower was doomed.
"Don't know that there's much more to say, Perrin," Tom said, leaning back in his chair, tobacco smoke curling out of his long-stemmed pipe. It was a warm night, and they didn't have a fire in the hearth, just a few candles on the table with some bread, cheeses, and a pitcher of ale. Perrin puffed on his own pipe. Only he, Tom, and Matt were in the room. Gaul and Grady waited out in the common room. Matt had cursed Perrin for bringing those two, and Aiel and an Ashaman were rather conspicuous. But Perrin felt safer with those two than with an entire company of soldiers. He'd shared his story with Matt and Tom first, speaking of Maldon, the Prophet, Aleandra, and Galad. Then they had filled him in on their experiences. It stunned Perrin how much had happened to the three of them since their parting. "Empress of the Shan Shan, eh?" Perrin said, watching the smoke twist above him in the dim room.
"Daughter of the Nine Moons," Matt said. "It's different."
"And you're married?" Perrin grinned. "Matrim Cawthon. Married."
"You didn't have to share that part, you know," Matt said to Tom.
"Oh, I assure you, I did indeed."
"For a gleeman, you seem to leave out most of the heroic parts of the things I do," Matt said. "At least you mentioned the hat."
Perrin smiled, contented. He hadn't realized how much he'd missed sitting with friends to spend the evening chatting. A carved wooden sign hung outside the window, dripping with rainwater. It depicted faces wearing strange hats and exaggerated smiles. The Happy Throng. There was probably a story behind the name. The three of them were in a private dining chamber paid for by Matt. They'd brought in three of the inn's large hearth chairs. They didn't fit the table, but they were comfortable. Matt leaned back, putting his feet up on the table. He took up a hunk of ewe's milk cheese and bit off a piece, then balanced the rest on his chair arm.
"You know, Matt," Perrin said, "your wife is probably going to expect you to be taught table manners."
"Oh, I've been taught," Matt said. "I just never learned."
"I'd like to meet her," Perrin said.
"She's something interesting," Tom replied.
"Interesting," Matt said. "Yeah."
He looked wistful.
"Anyway, you've heard the lot of it now, Perrin. That bloody Brown brought us here. Haven't seen her in over 2 weeks now."
"Can I see the note?" Perrin asked. Matt patted a few pockets, then fished out a small white piece of paper, folded closed and sealed with red wax. He tossed it onto the table. The corners were bent, the paper smudged, but it hadn't been opened. Matrim Cawthon was a man of his word, at least when you could pry an oath out of him. Perrin lifted the note. It smelled faintly of perfume. He turned it over, then held it up to a candle.
"Doesn't work," Matt said.
Perrin grunted. "So what do you think it says?"
"Don't know," Matt said. "Bloody insane Aes Sedai. I mean, they're all odd. But Varen's fallen completely off her stone. Don't suppose you've heard from her?"
"I haven't."
"Hope she's all right," Matt said. "She sounded worried something might happen to her."
He took the note back, then tapped it on the table. "You going to open it?" Matt shook his head.
"I'll open it when I get back.
A knock came at the door, then it creaked open, revealing the innkeeper, a younger man named Denizel. He was tall, with a lean face, and a head he kept shaved. The man was all but dragon-sworn, from what Perrin had seen, even going so far as to have a portrait of Rand commissioned and hung in the common room. It wasn't a bad likeness.
"I apologize, Master Crimson," Denizel said, "but Master Golden's man insisted on speaking with him."
"It's all right," Perrin said. Grady poked his weathered face into the room and Denizel retreated.
"Oh, Grady," Matt said, waving. "Blown up anyone interesting lately?"
The Tand Ashaman frowned, looking to Perrin.
"My lord, Lady Fael asked me to remind you when midnight arrived."
Matt whistled.
"See? This is why I left my wife in another kingdom."
Grady's frown deepened. "Thank you, Grady," Perrin said with a sigh. "I hadn't realized the time. We'll be going soon." The Ashaman nodded, then withdrew.
"Burn him," Matt said. "Can't the man at least smile? Flaming sky is depressing enough without people like him trying to imitate it."
"Well, son," Tom said, pouring some ale, "some just don't find the world particularly humorous lately."
"Nonsense," Matt said. "The world's plenty humorous. The whole bloody place has been laughing at me lately. I'm telling you, Perrin, with those drawings of us about,
You need to keep your head low.
I don't see how I can, Perrin said. I've got an army to lead, people to care for.
I don't think you're taking Varen's warning seriously enough, lad, Tom said, shaking his head.
You ever heard of the Bannerth people?
No, Perrin said, looking at Matt.
They were a group of savages who roamed what is now Almuth Plain, Tom said. I know a couple fine songs about them. See, their various tribes always painted the skin of their leader red to make him stand out.
Matt took another bite of his cheese. Bloody fools. Painted their leader red? That would make him a target for every soldier on the field.
That was the point, Tom said. It was a challenge, you see. How else would their enemies be able to find him and test their skill against him?
Matt snorted. I'd have painted a few decoy soldiers red to distract them from me, then had my archers feather their leader with arrows while everyone was trying to hunt down the fellows they thought were leading my army.
Actually, Tom said, taking a sip of his ale, that's exactly what William Bloodletter did during his first and last battle with them. The Song of 100 Days talks about it. Brilliant maneuver. I'm surprised you've heard of that song. It's very obscure, and the battle happened so long ago, most history books don't even remember it.
For some reason, the comment made Matt smell nervous.
You're saying that we're making ourselves targets, Perrin said.
I'm saying, Tom replied, that you boys are getting harder and harder to hide. Everywhere you go, banners proclaim your arrival. People talk about you. I'm half convinced you have only survived this long because the Forsaken didn't know where to find you.
Perrin nodded, thinking of the trap his army had nearly fallen into. Assassins in the night would come.
So what should I do?
Matt's been sleeping in a different tent each night, Tom said, and sometimes in the city. You should try something like that. Grady can make gateways, right? Why not have him make one for you into the middle of your tent each night? Sneak out and sleep someplace else, then travel back in the morning. Everyone will assume you're in your tent. If assassins strike, you won't be there.
Perrin nodded thoughtfully.
Even better, I could leave 5 or 6 Aiel inside on alert, waiting.
Perrin, Matt said, that's downright devious. He smiled. You've changed for the better, my friend.
From you, I'll try to accept that as a compliment, Perrin said.
He paused, then added,
It will be difficult.
Tom chuckled.
He's right, though. You've changed. What happened to the soft-spoken, unsure boy I helped escape the Two Rivers?
He passed through the blacksmith's fire, Perrin said softly.
Tom nodded, seeming to understand.
And you, Matt? Perrin said. Can I do something to help you? Maybe let you travel between tents?
No, I'll be fine.
How are you going to protect yourself?
With my wits.
Planning to find some of those, then?
Perrin said.
About time.
Matt snorted. What is it with everyone in my wits lately? I'll be fine, trust me. Remind me to tell you about the night when I first figured out I could win whatever dice game I wanted to. It's a good story. Involves falling off bridges. One bridge, at least.
Well, you could tell us now, Perrin said.
Not the right time. Anyway, it doesn't matter. See, I'm leaving soon. Tom smelled excited. Perrin, you will lend us a gateway, won't you? Matt asked. Hate to leave the band. They'll be inconsolable without me. At least they have those dragons to blow things up.
But where are you going? Perrin asked.
Suppose I should explain it, Matt said. That was the reason for meeting with you, aside from the amiable discourse and all. He leaned in. Perrin, Moraine is alive.
What?
It's true, Matt said. Or, well, we think it is. She sent Tom a letter claiming she'd foreseen the battle with Lanfear and knew that she would... Well, anyway, there's this tower west of here on the River Aranel. It's made of all metal. It...
The Tower of Genji, Perrin said softly. Yes, I know of it.
Matt blinked.
You do?
Burn me. When did you get to be a scholar?
I've merely heard some things. Matt, that place is evil.
Well, Moraine is inside, Matt said. Captured. I mean to get her back. I have to beat the snakes and the foxes. Bloody cheats.
Snakes and foxes, Perrin said.
Tom nodded.
The children's game is named after the things that live in the tower. So we think.
I've seen them, Matt said. And... Well, there's really not time for that now.
If you're going to rescue her, Perrin said, perhaps I could come, or at least send one of the Ashaman.
I'll take a gateway gladly, Matt said. But you can't come, Perrin. Moraine explained it in her letter. Only three can come. And I know already who they have to be.
He hesitated.
Alvar is going to bloody kill me for not taking him, you know.
Matt, Perrin said, shaking his head. You're not making any sense.
Matt sighed. Let me tell you the whole story, then. He eyed the pitcher of ale. We're going to need more of that, and you'd better tell Grady you'll be some time yet.